The title is, I've changed the title slightly to The Bible Above All Holy Books. And this is a topic, of course, of great significance. Someone has said that about every 600 years, there arises at some point or another in history a great religious or moral reformer. And actually, if you look at the chronology, around 1450 to 1250 BC, on the scene emerges Moses and Hinduism. About 800 to 600 BC, Confucius comes onto the scene, along with Buddha, and then, of course, in the Bible, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Then, of course, around zero, just for round terms, Jesus. And then about 600 AD, Muhammad. I do find that sort of an interesting observation. It's one that I had never recognized before. I don't know exactly what I'm supposed to make of it, but it is a peculiar development in human history. But as we think in terms of the all holy books, it's important for us to recognize, and I'm going to start here. I don't know what all David had in mind when he gave me the topic, but I want to talk in terms of the relationship of the Bible and God's revelation within the context of ancient contemporary religions. Not so much Hindu in this case, or Buddhism, but as far as the Egyptians and Mesopotamians and Greco-Roman world is concerned. Because that is the arena within which then the children of Israel are going to emerge, and of course Christianity is going to begin and spread from Palestine, not in the modern political sense of the term, but spread from Palestine into all of the world. But as we think in terms of what is unfolding here, the mid-19th century AD is when things really begin to break loose in all of this. The discoveries are not necessarily being made at this point, although it's not until then that some of them are made. People were long aware of hieroglyphics and Egyptian writing long before this, but nobody could read it. Similarly with Akkadian. People were aware of some of this stuff, but they couldn't read it. Akkadian did not begin to be deciphered until the early 1800s, and only then did they begin to be able to read that ancient contemporary literature that was contemporary with the Bible and with the Old Testament periods. As we think in terms of what unfolds there, most of you are familiar with the Epic of Gilgamesh or Atrahasis and so forth. And the discovery of Ashurbanipal's library did not take place until about 1845. And because Akkadian was still in its early years of decipherment, it took a number of years not only for them to refine the understanding of Akkadian, but also then with the discovery of the tablets, they were now then in the latter part of the 19th century finally able to find some material that sort of sounded like the flood stories. And of course, this among the skeptics, this really hit the heyday. The argument, of course, that the Bible borrowed from the ancient Mesopotamian world, which I don't buy into, but this is an element that kicked into the discussion and has become an ongoing part of evaluation in regards to biblical studies and oftentimes criticisms leveled against the scriptures. Hieroglyphics, of course, and it's interesting that last year was the 100th anniversary of the decipherment of hieroglyphics. In 1822, even though people were fully aware of the fact that they existed, nobody could read it until Champollion comes along and he deciphers this using the Rosetta Stone that had been discovered in 1799 and that the British became possessors of. It's now in the British Museum. Many of you have probably seen it. And he breaks the code using the Greek as sort of the beginning point, recognizing some repetitive issues that tend to characterize hieroglyphics and assuming that those repetitive issues are characteristic of the repetition in the Greek text. Now, that's a terrible oversimplification of how the decipherment occurred. But nonetheless, with the breakthrough that occurred here, the scholarly world was able now to translate all of those, or to begin translating all of those hieroglyphic documents and wall paintings and wall carvings and so forth that permeated Egyptian society. And among those were the discoveries of religious texts and the belief and the religious system that characterized the ancient world. I want to talk briefly about some of the Egyptian concepts of the world. and the creation accounts that are there. I hesitate to call these holy books, but they're sort of scattered around in different sources, but nonetheless, they do serve as sort of the holy books of early Egyptian development. First, there was Nun, to be pronounced Nun, not Nun. And Nun was sort of, I hesitate to call him a god because there's a sense in which even in the literature he's not a god, but he was sort of an inert force that just sort of happens to exist. Makes for an interesting kind of cosmological question, comes into the picture. But from that source comes Atum, who in this context, in the sources, is a self-created god. I've never quite figured that one out. How do you create yourself? But that's sort of how they set this idea forth. And some of the logic of all of this really, really, really escapes me. But nonetheless, these are the avenues that they set forth. Now, from Atum, you have two deities that come on the source, Shu and Neftut, who are siblings. And some will argue that Neftut is a twin feminine form of Shu, who is the god of air, if you will. Now, the god of air in this case should be understood as the domain within which we operate. It's not necessarily the air that we breathe, although that's a component of it, but it is an element of the activities of humanity as we carry on in our lives. Now, from these two, there are two gods that come onto the scene, Gabe and Nut. And again, this should be pronounced Nut, not Nut, okay? Sometimes it may seem like a nut, but nonetheless. And it's not an almond joy. But anyway, so Gabe and Nut are the deities, and they are offspring who then have relationships. Notice the incestuous kind of element that characterizes this. I often refer to the Egyptian pharaonic family tree, not as a family tree, but it's a family post. Anyway, so the deity world functions in the same kind of capacity. A lot of incestuous elements that come into play, which therefore would not be surprising that the pharaonic and kingly line in Egypt functions very incestuously. But from Gabe and Nut come four major deities that come on the scene. Osiris, who is sort of the head god, if you will, and his sister wife, who is Isis, not to be confused with the terrorist group, all right? That's another ballgame. Then there is Seth, who is another male deity whose sister wife is Nephthys. And so these two get together and things happen. Now, in the process of all of this, Seth gets ticked off at Osiris and kills him. And Isis then, being the discouraged housewife, I don't remember the name of that show anyway, but most of you are familiar with it, but a frustrated homemaker here, can't find someone with whom to mate, and so Seth has chopped Osiris up and distributed his body parts all over Egypt. And there is a desperate search to find all of the body parts and put them back together so that Isis and Osiris can mate. A strange world of theology. Now, what you have to understand it is, this is part of the context out of which the Old Testament emerges. And there's a vastly different dynamic that characterizes the Hebrew Bible in contrast to this. Now, this is a picture that many of you probably have seen in Bible handbooks, ancient history books, and so forth and so on, but this is a portrayal of how the Egyptians perceive the universe. The woman that is arched over this is Nut. She's the sky goddess. And below her are several deities, one of whom is Gabe, who is the earth. And Gabe is separated from Nut by Shu, air, who separates these and keeps them apart from one another. And so this is sort of the concept within which they would look at their world. Now, Shu is therefore important to hold and separate the sky from the earth so it doesn't collapse on each other. All right? Now, another element that comes into this is that Nut serves as the framework within which they describe the day. So all of us are certainly aware of the fact the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, are trying to make sense of this. Now, to a certain degree, we have to recognize that these ancient mythologies many times, not all the times, but many times are attempts to try to explain their world. It's sort of a science theory, if you will. We would not buy into the science, of course, but nonetheless, they're attempting to explain how their world functions. And the way they describe this is that as the sun sets, Nut has swallowed the sun and will pass through her body and reemerge the next morning in the east where the sun shines again. And this cycle goes over and over and over on 24-hour cycles. Now, there's another feature of this that comes in peculiarly, and it has to do with the dung beetle. And most of us would look at the dung beetle as, you know, a strange little critter. I don't know if you've ever watched dung beetles work, but they're, first you have to be sort of impressed with their industriousness and their diligence. And the dung beetle becomes associated with the sun god. Now, a number of years ago when I was in graduate school at Arizona, there was an Egyptologist that came through and sort of explained the dynamic of why this comes into play. So the ancient Egyptians see the dung beetle out there in the field, cuts off its ball of dung, rolls it along and buries it, and then sometime later life comes out of this hole where the dung beetle had buried the ball of dung. And to them this was life from death kind of thing. And so the sun becomes, and the dung beetle becomes sort of a description of how life emerges. They certainly understood the value of the sunlight in order for us to exist. But eventually, and many of you may recognize this, this is a dung beetle that has the wings spread, pushing the red ball of the sun around in its locations. And so the scarab becomes part of the religious drama and dynamic of the Egyptian world. Now, there are hundreds of gods. I sometimes facetiously describe it as here a god, there a god, everywhere a god god. And so they worship all kinds of deities, and it's impossible for us to sort of synthesize all of this, except in a nutshell point out that they're very polytheistic. And they would have their individual gods that they would be worshiping. There would be their national gods. But this is not particularly unique to the Egyptians. Now, when we move forward in this and we look at the Egyptian world, and sadly, I can't read the screen very well, so I'm going to have to step over here and look at this. This is sort of a summary of some of the elements of the Egyptian accounts. There was one god, I put that in quotes because an inert god, I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, one god created the other gods, but yet there were these chaotic kinds of descriptions. Now, the chaotic descriptions is where did all the other gods come from? Once we get to Osiris and Atum and so forth and so on, one of the avenues of Egyptian theology says that Atum was sitting there on his little dry area and he's making up names for his body parts, and as he names them, then a god erupts. Another one argues, and I'm going to phrase this very delicately as I can, is that the other gods come from his self-manipulation. And as we think in terms of the contrast, I hesitate to use the word compare, but as we think in terms of the contrast between these Egyptian kinds of motifs and the Bible, it stands out in bold relief. We continue in the discussion. There is the gods competing and fighting with one another, and hence the implied element of the last point, the humans needing to be concerned about with which god are you aligned, because if the gods are fighting amongst themselves, then if you happen to be on the wrong side of this issue, you may become sort of a peripheral victim of the wrath of one of the deities. Human beings are largely irrelevant in all of this. They come about more as an after effect, as Horus has been looking for elements of the divine and then weeps when they're found, and from the weeping tears, humans emerge. Now, admittedly, some of the Egyptian material will talk about humanity in a fairly lofty kind of way compared with other kinds of ancient literature, but nonetheless, certainly nothing in the capacity that the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament will discuss. So humans are largely peripheral in all of this. Now, look at the contrast with the Bible. One God who creates it all. And in this one creation, you have an issue where while the earth is without form and void, that does not mean that there's chaos going on. I often would liken this to when I would be watching my wife cook, and she would gather up the flour and the oil and everything else, and to me it looks chaotic. It's without form. And then she applies her energies and mixes all that together, and something wonderful emerges that that's sort of, don't overpress this, but that's sort of how I envision God doing. In the beginning, the earth was void and without form, but God takes that and he forms it into something that is good. And repeatedly within the biblical text, you're going to have the harmonious advance of the creation of the world and the repeated definition and declaration, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, contrary to the kinds of things that tend to characterize a lot of the Egyptian material. Implicitly there, therefore, there's no need for any other gods. And of course, God is going to expect and want human beings to worship him and him alone. And that, of course, is one of the ongoing turmoils that characterizes the children of Israel, and even to a point, the Greco-Roman world within which Christianity is going to emerge. Now, we shift now to the Mesopotamian world. This is part of one of the tablets of the epic creation that was discovered in the Library of Ashurbanipal, dating from around the 7th century B.C., although all scholars will tend to suggest that the literature itself derives from a lot earlier. I find it interesting, Dave, that they will recognize the legitimacy of that when it comes to secular stuff, but not from the Bible. Anyway, that's another whole discussion. So when we think in terms of the Mesopotamian world and the pantheon under consideration here, you have several deities again. There are the gods of inactivity and chaos. So they're the chaotic gods, and they're gods that are going to bring order. And among the chaotic gods are Apsu, who is the sweet water, Tiamat, who is the sea, and the offspring of Apsu and Tiamat are Anu and Enlil. Now, I don't have time to go into all the details here by any means, and admittedly, I don't know all the details because this is a huge avenue of investigation. But the gods of order are going to come along, and they are going to address the issues. Anu is the sky cosmic god, and Enlil is the god of storms. But there's a god named Marduk who's going to come on the scene, and he is eventually going to become the head of the pantheon. And one of the things that he's going to do is he's going to kill Tiamat. And he shoves a blast of wind into her mouth, and she bloats up and explodes. And from part of that, the sky is made. From part of that, the earth is made. And the blood that emerges then becomes the formation of human beings. It's sort of a weird kind of storyline. But nonetheless, this is the dynamic that characterized them. Now, this is a seal impression, a cylinder seal impression, that shows Marduk over here slaying Tiamat. It doesn't show the rest of the storyline, but again, this is part of the drama and dynamic of the Mesopotamian religious world. So when we think in terms, though, and go to the Canaanite world, this, by the way, is the arena with which I'm most familiar of these, because my biblical archaeology world functions significantly within the framework of the Canaanite world. But there are, in the Canaanite world, there start off basically two gods, El and Asherah. Now, these are terms, of course, with which you're familiar from the Old Testament. El is a generic word. It's not necessarily a formal name here, but El is a generic word, and he was the creator god. By the way, these tablets were not discovered until the late 1920s, so we had sort of contemporary sympathetic literature that describes the Canaanite world, which basically corroborated what the Old Testament told us about these. So El and Asherah are husband and wife. Asherah is the goddess of fertility, and they are going to have several sons, several children. Among them are Baal and Anat and Mot and 67 other kids. All right, I'm not going to go into the discussion because the others are, I'm not going to say they're irrelevant, but nonetheless, I want to focus upon the relationship between Baal and Anat and Mot. Now again, thinking in terms of their attempt to make explanation or to explain the dynamic of their world, a lot of this focuses upon these bottom three deities. Now, by the time the Hebrew people emerge, what has happened is Asherah and Anat have melded. El has sort of faded from the scene. And so you have, in the Old Testament period, basically Baal and Asherah functioning as brother-sister relationships. But the early Canaanite world, they're a little still separated. And Baal and Anat, when they get together, that's when the crops grow. That's when the rains come. That's when everything is working as it ought to work. And everything's good. Now, if you live in that part of the world, I really don't know what the weather patterns are here in Florida, but I get the impression it rains here a lot. I know it does in Arkansas. But if you're in the Middle East, there is a very, very distinct time frame of rain time and not rain. And it's like, boom. It's almost like flipping a switch as you move from one to the other. And so when the rains stop, of course, you're going to have a decline in water resources and a decline in the fertility and productivity of the land and all that kind of thing. And so in the ancient world, they described and thought that Mot, who is the god of death, has come along and killed Baal. Well, Anat, or Asherah, as a desperate housewife, that was the term I was trying to remember, as a desperate housewife type, searches around trying to find someone with whom to mate and never can find anyone. And she finally goes to Mot, takes out her sword, hacks him to death, retrieves the body parts of Baal, put them back together, and they mate. This is a different world. Now, this is exactly the kind of world within which the Hebrew people emerge. Baal is the rain god, the storm god, the ice, the lightning, and all of that. And, of course, the story, the episode of Elijah on Mount Carmel is targeting that specifically. But notice in the narrative there in Kings, it is Baal, the prophets of Baal, and the prophets of Asherah who are there. And both of these are involved in the propagation of the worship of these deities. And of course, the Lord is incensed at what is going on, trying to get the children of Israel to understand and to grow up, to mature in their understanding of the nature of God. Now, in a nutshell, when we look at the Canaanite gods, El is the creator god. All right, he's sort of retired in this. Baal is the god of snow, rain, lightning, thunder. Asherah slash Anat is the goddess of fertility of the fields, fertility of the flocks, fertility of the families. And Mot is the god of death. Listen to what the Bible says. The Bible will talk in terms of, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In chapter 2, this is defined. Elohim here is defined more specifically, in a sense, as Yahweh, in the day that the Lord God made the heavens and the earth. Not just any old God, but Yahweh, the God of the children of Israel. And then you have references in Jeremiah where Jeremiah, a host of passages might be noted, but Jeremiah will talk in terms of God being the one who creates. Or look in terms of the rain and lightning and thunder, Genesis chapter 2, verse 5, when God is going to send the rain on the earth. And the crops begin to reproduce. And again, Jeremiah chapter 10 will speak in similar fashion. Asherah is the goddess of the fields, family, and flocks. Well, specifically in Deuteronomy verse chapter 30, you have God pointing out, I am the one who is the helps you produce your family and your flocks and your fields. And he describes all of the elements that they are falsely attributing to Asherah, or in earlier periods, Anat. And of course, God is the one who controls the issue of death, as he is the one who raises even that servant, or as Elisha raises the child from the dead, and as then that weird story where the individual dies and they throw him into the tomb where Elisha is and he pops out. That's a bizarre story, no matter how you look at it. But Yahweh is the God who gives life. God is the one who controls death. And of course, in the New Testament, Jesus is the one who brings to the end him who has the power of death, that is the devil. So when we think in terms of some common elements of the Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Canaanite stories, what I want us to catch here is that you have in those stories a chaos of nature. It is extremely chaotic. And you can imagine how frustrated human beings are in trying to sort of sort their way through all of this and to try to make sense of it. Secondly, you have the chaos among the gods themselves. They don't get along. And so then the lurking question is, what god are you going to worship or serve? Then you have the issue of the physical and sensual character of these deities. They're lustful, they're murderous, they're conniving, and all of that kind of thing. You have an element of the Egyptian gods of sneezing or self-manipulation, and people are from the tears of Atum. Then you have in the Mesopotamian world the slaying of Tiamat, using the carcass to make the universe, uses the blood to make people. And similarly, in the Mesopotamian world, you have an issue where they make the people in order to do the works the gods are tired of doing, which I find interesting. You know, a bunch of lazy gods. But in all of these, to a large extent, people are fundamentally irrelevant. And they're used to perform the tasks that the gods don't want to do, and or they are just irritants to the gods. And that's one reason why in Gilgamesh you have the story that it lets a flood on them all, because they're too noisy down there. This is a different kind of world. Now, we're shifting gears to compare this to the Greek and Roman gods. Most of you are familiar enough with this from probably junior high and so forth. When you think in terms of the whimsical, capricious nature of the Greek and Roman gods, their murderous character, their sensual and adulterous behavior, their lying and duplicitous, they are dishonest and thieving. They have no interest really in humanity except as something to use, perhaps. And they're only seen by people as beings, as gods, to manipulate, appease, placate, or perhaps try to take advantage of. There's a sense in which these gods, almost all of them, are sort of glorified images of the weaknesses of humanity. And I find it interesting that Paul talks in terms of Romans chapter 1. You've taken the creature and made it the creator. And God lambasts the Greco-Roman world, which would not be just the Greco-Roman world, but humanity in general, for our topsy-turvy approach to what the universe is really all about. In the Bible, God created everything as good from the very get-go. It's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. The only thing it's not good, and we'll come to this in a moment, is that it's not good the man be alone. Now, I don't think that that was a deficiency on God's part. Okay, I think that was a point to be made to Adam. Look, bud, you're all by yourself. So that he would appreciate the creation of Eve when Eve is then made and brought to him. So, and if you look at how that story unfolds, it's very clear that Adam recognizes, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. I mean, he seems like exuberant that I finally found a companion with whom to share life. God of the Bible is someone who needs nothing from us. God says in Psalms, if I were hungry, would I ask you? You know, and it's very sarcastic. Of course, God doesn't get hungry. But God is the one who controls all of this. And of course, Paul in Acts chapter 17 will talk in terms about it is in God that we live and move and have our being. He doesn't dwell in temples made with men's hands as though he needed anything. To the contrary, we are the ones who are intrinsically dependent upon him. Human beings in the story of the Bible are deliberately created and desired creatures. I don't mean that in a pejorative kind of way, but in Genesis chapter 1, let us make people, man, in our image, in our likeness. And then you have in chapter 2, verse 7, God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. There's a sense in which we share in the nature of God, which Peter, by the way, will point out. He's given his divine nature to us. Now, don't go pantheistic on us here. Don't go Shirley MacLaine on us, okay? But there is an element within which we as human beings, being alive, share in the nature of God, and when we die, the Spirit returns to God. Thirdly, you have the issue there where God is concerned for our well-being. And when I look at the issue of it is not good that the man should be alone, the issue is not deficiency on God's part. Oops, I made a mistake here. That's not the issue. The issue is to make Adam aware of the fact, I want you to be a whole being. And I want you to appreciate the companion that I provide for you. And a fourth element we can consider is God wants to be with us. I don't have this up here, but in the episode where God comes to them in the cool of the day, the garden, I sometimes describe this, and I hope you don't take this in the bad way. He comes for afternoon tea with his creation. And they've messed up. Where are you? Again, God's not oblivious. Have you ever played hide and seek with a 2-year-old? Where's Susie? Where's Susie? You know exactly where Susie is. You can see her little butt sticking out behind the couch, you know. But God is trying to impress upon them, think about what's going on, Adam and Eve. And God desires that relationship with us. He seeks that companionship. He pursues it. In John chapter 3, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. For God commends his love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And he seeks us so that he can be found if people are really serious about trying to find him. Now, admittedly, so many people are prejudiced and they don't want to find what they can find. They don't want the implications of what God expects of us. While he is a God of love, he's also a God of justice. And there are expectations that God has of humanity. Briefly, I'm going to shift now to Hinduism and Buddhism. Admittedly, this is not my wheelhouse, if you will. All right. And I'm sort of going to combine these, and I realize this is going to be sort of a crass overview. But Hinduism is very much a long evolved religion. And I hesitate almost to call it a religion, because it's pantheistic in nature. If there is a theism at all, it is more viewed as a principle of an idea. But people will talk in terms of the divine element here. But the goal ultimately is to pass through this world into transmigration. Fancy word for reincarnation. And the reason for that is recognizing that there's a lot of things in this world that are just miserable. And a lot of people in the world that are miserable. You and I here in this auditorium are among the most privileged and wealthy individuals on the face of the earth. And we should be thankful for that. Not that we're, you know, more than others, but we should be thankful for what we have. But there are millions and billions of people around the face of the world who are in abject poverty and misery. And for them, the view is get out of it in some fashion. To be absorbed into the essential nothingness, where I'm not conscious really of anything, and that's the ultimate existence. When we think in terms of Buddhism, Buddhism has similar kinds of elements. Now, there are differences between the two. I understand that. But focusing upon the idea of transmigration, i.e. reincarnation, the idea here is to renounce the joys and comforts of this world into an asceticism. And so you do that through yoga, migrate through the cycle of life, and emerge out on the other side into some absorbed element of the end of existence so that you're not conscious at all. Sounds real hopeful. Sounds real rewarding. Pardon my sarcasm. Now, this is part of the reason for the problem of the caste system. Because in these systems, the idea, all of us have heard of karma. I would hesitate actually using that word. Usually we sort of redefine it and reuse it, but the idea of karma is you get what you do, it comes back on you. It's sort of the wheel that keeps going. It's sort of payback. Now, admittedly, the Bible will talk about the idea sometimes of retributive principle, but karma is way beyond that. And the issue here is the rationale of the impenetrable. If your behavior is such that you are reincarnated in the state that you are, then, okay, why should I help you? Because you're there because of your own doing. And breaking through the caste system is problematic. Now, in more modern times, as other influences come in, there has been a breakdown of some of this, but nonetheless, the caste system is still very, very, very apparent in India and the Southeast Asian world. Now, in this, both of these are fundamentally, surprisingly, atheistic. Again, when we think in terms of pantheism, pantheism is basically an argument that, you know, sort of God is everything, and heavily slanted toward a self-advancement. It's what I do or don't do through meditation and all of this and trying to move through this cycle and get to another level where I'm sort of absorbed into relative oblivion. Now, compare that with the Bible. In the Bible, God is not at all portrayed in a pantheistic way. He's separate and apart from the universe. He's an independent entity. And all people have dignity and value in his eyes. So the caste system is out of the picture, if we're fair-minded in how this unfolds. And the Bible provides the avenue of salvation and hope and direction by which we can cope with this world in anticipation of, yes, the greater that God has given us and the grace and mercy that he offers, which become vital components to understand his offering and our value. So it defines who we are. Now, quickly, apparently quickly needs to be quick. Some Islamic terms that you're familiar with. The word Islam comes from a triliteral root. I'm going to do a little bit of Hebrew here, Semitic languages here. All of you have heard of the word shalom, okay? The word Islam is a derivation from the same concept. And it has to do with peace or submission or safety. Religiously, as far as the Islamic people are concerned, it has to do with submission to the will of God. When you hear the idea that Islam is a religion of peace, it is not a religion of peace between people necessarily. It is supposedly a religion of peace between humans and God. Okay. Now that would not intrinsically exclude some element of peace, although I think it's critically important in this evaluation not to look at how religion has been applied. If that's the case, Christianity has a big black eye. Okay, because you know, people who call themselves Christians have not always done a good job being Christians. So we need to look at what the documents will talk in terms of. Now, when we think in terms of another term, Muslim is a active participle. Remember grammar? Probably don't want to. But it means one who submits. From the same word, shalom, or salam. And the word Mohammedism is a word you really, if you want to be fair with Islamic friends, don't refer to their religion as Mohammedism. Because in their mind, it implies, and you may subscribe to this, and I do personally, I do think it's a religion that came from Muhammad, and that largely he made it up. But it's an insult to them because they look at it as being, you're saying that our religion is not from God. So if you want to continue a conversation, don't use this word, all right? Don't muddy the waters with terminology that's just going to rankle people right off the bat. So these are some terms that you need at least to be familiar with. Now, five pillars of Islam are very commonly known, and all of us have heard of these. One of them has to do with the declaration of faith, that there is one God who is Allah. I'm not quoting, I don't subscribe to this, okay? There's one God who is Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. I don't subscribe to this at all, but this is the declaration of faith that characterizes Islam. And this is something that must be said in order for one to be and believe to become a Muslim. And secondly, it is something that is supposed to be declared five times a day. A second pillar is prayer, five times a day toward Mecca in a prostrated position. Third pillar is the idea of almsgiving, which interestingly is not in the Quran. This is in additional documents that are varyingly viewed as to whether they're authoritative or not, named the Hadith. The fourth pillar is the idea of fasting, particularly the Ramadan. And most of us have at least heard of Ramadan in the news and so forth. And the last one is the pilgrimage, the Hajj to Mecca, the holy city. Now, when we think in terms of some other issues, there's the treatment of non-Muslims. And while admittedly we have to think in terms and be careful about how things are applied, they do talk in terms of people of the book, which would be those Jews and Christians. We are people of the book. Within parameters, there's a respect of that until they view us as intruding into their land. Okay. At which point then, because we have taken over their land, therefore we are enemies and deserve to receive punishment. Women and children are not respected in the sense that they should be. They are often taken into slavery. Heaven is very materialistic. You've heard about the 72 virgins if you die and so forth. Interesting, the Quran doesn't say that. Okay. But the Quran, the word, the Q up here stands for Quran. The Quran does talk in terms of women, implying that they are basically objects of physical pleasure in the afterlife. And you can look at the passages if you're interested. And then there is the jihad. The jihad is the idea of minimum eye for an eye. Retaliation against those who would drive you from your land. Think in terms of the modern state of Israel and the implications of that. And also then the reward for those who fight against unbelievers. And so unbelievers would be Christians, Jews, those who don't subscribe, and hence the reward given to those who do so. And again, the Quran will talk in terms of some of this. It's rather cryptic remarks, but nonetheless easily interpreted by those who want to interpret the scriptures accordingly. David's telling me I'm done. I'm not, but I am. I wanted to go through a very brief analysis and critique, but I think you've picked up enough to recognize, I mean, certainly if you're familiar with the Bible, you can immediately, on point by point by point, recognize, wait a minute, the Bible is in a different world and emerges. Why is it so different than all of these others unless it is of divine origin? In a nutshell, that's sort of where I end. May I close with a prayer? You'll bow with me, please.